hoping to hear good news soon. You learn a lot about a story based on how the story begins. Some of you might know what I mean before I say anything more. But if I say to a group of children, "Gather around, kids, it's time for a story," I can start that story multiple ways that will send different messages about what the tone and the setting of the story. For example, if I start a story with the words, "Once upon a time," what does that tell you? It indicates to you that as I start the story, things are generally okay, probably. The story begins in a place, probably, of relative peace. Now, if I gather those same children around and I begin the story this way by saying, "So there I was." Or, "It was a dark and stormy night," right? If I do that, it communicates something totally different, doesn't it? It's more ominous, and it hints that the story starts not in a position of relative peace, but in the middle of a tough situation. Today and next week, we are looking at the beginning of the Exodus story. Chapters 1 and 2, they give us the setting of the Exodus story. They build the scene. And so we're going to pay close attention to how the story starts. God will meet us in many ways and show us many things in Exodus, but today we see just the very beginning. And at the beginning, we'll read in a moment, you will notice right away that things are not good. Things are not good with this brand new nation called Israel at the start of Exodus. And things aren't just kind of bad. No, in fact, the setting, I would just call it bleak regarding the nation of Israel and any hope they might have. So let's just begin by looking at the setting of this story. I'm going to read Exodus chapter 1, just verses 1 through 7. I won't ask you to stand today just because we're covering an entire chapter, although we'd all be more sore tomorrow if I did. But would you read along with me in Exodus chapter 1, verses just 1 through 7 for now? "These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them." Well, so far, so good, right? Because to have a nation, you need to have people. And so here we read that God is taking care of that. The people of Israel are increasing and they are multiplying, so much so that the text says they filled the land. Now remember, this is part of what God promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If you remember back in Genesis 35, among other places, I read this. God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Paddan Aram and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. No longer shall your name be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel. And God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come from your own body. The land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your offspring after you." So this is the promise God made, remember. He's going to give them a place to live. He's going to dwell among them. They are going to be a blessing to all the nations, but first they need to be a people. You need people to be a people. So God told them, be fruitful and multiply. And in the first 7 verses, that's happening. The 70 people who started in Egypt have become a nation. And so we say, well, wow, you've already contradicted yourself. That's not bleak at all. That's quite good. What is the problem? Well, let me read on verses 8 through 14. "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, 'Behold, the people of Israel are too many, and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses, but the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel, so they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. This is not a nation of free people. This is a nation of slaves. The people of God are a nation of slaves. How does that fit in with God's promises? That's a wonderful question. Tuck it in your back pocket because the rest of Exodus will answer it. Now, we meet characters in a story, and this is a story. We just met the bad guy. He is Pharaoh. He is king over Egypt. He has power. He has wealth. He has influence, and he has resources at his disposal, and he hates the people of God. He dreads them. He oppresses them ruthlessly. The more he works them, the more children they have. The more they grow, the more he dreads them. So things are on what we might call a downward spiral as he increases in hate toward them. Pharaoh, who has kept his eye pretty closely on the population growth of these Hebrews, finally has his tipping point, and things take what we might call a very murderous step further in verses 15 and 16. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live." Friends, we are meant to observe that this story of Exodus starts pretty badly. Never mind that the nation isn't in their own land. They have legs, they can walk, they can get there. No, they can't get there because, oh yeah, they're made slaves to another nation. And that's a problem that will require fixing. Now, even worse, measures have been taken to actually stop the growth of this nation and cause it to reseed and shrink. That's the point of killing the males. Not to get too scientific here, but you need the males if you want the population to grow. Pharaoh has enslaved the people of God. But that wasn't enough. Pharaoh is now seeking to destroy the people of God by removing their future. Things are bleak. It was a dark and stormy night. This is a bad start to a story. If Pharaoh had his way, the nation of Israel would begin, live, and end its existence in Egypt as slaves. So if we haven't figured this out yet, Pharaoh is the bad guy. Maybe that's an obvious statement, but he is the bad guy. In the Exodus story, especially this first half, which is chapters 1 through 18, that's the first half of Exodus, roughly, in terms of how it's structured. Pharaoh is the bad guy. Because God has said, these are my people. I am creating them for my purposes. I have plans for them. God says that. But Pharaoh is also saying, no, these are my people. I will use them for my own devices. I will even destroy them if I see it fit. This will come out more when we get to the plagues. But this story is very much a God versus Pharaoh account. The one true God versus the self-proclaimed, finite, deluded man who wants to be God. It's a mismatch, to be sure. But right now, at this moment, it seems that Pharaoh holds the controls and that Pharaoh is calling the shots. Now, I don't know if you've seen the old Batman show from the 1960s. Yes, starring Adam West as Batman. Often in that show, if you've watched it, too often probably, a scene or an episode would end with Batman tied up or bound somehow, and he's being gradually lowered or gradually pulled or drawn or on a conveyor, gradually moving toward what? A device that was designed to ensure his demise, while the Joker or the Riddler, you know, stood by laughing or gloating. And so as a kid watching that, you ask, is there any hope? Because even a glimmer of hope in a hard situation goes a long way. We're looking at Exodus and we're seeing the people of God enslaved and oppressed and now shrinking. And we're asking, is there even a glimmer of hope? This story is off to a bad start. And we do get a glimmer of hope. We do get a glimmer of hope in this first chapter of Exodus. That glimmer shows us some things about God, and it shows us some things about His people and how we are to fear Him. Let me read again, just beginning in verse 15, verses 15 through 17. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him, but if it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. I have a proposition today, and it's three easy words. Fear God always. Fear God always. I have two short points that I think you're going to support that proposition. And the first is this: fear God in the face of God's enemies. Fear God in the face of God's enemies. So let's pause for a moment and talk about these women. They're called the midwives, but they are probably not the only two midwives for the entire nation of Israel. Probably. They are likely the two head ladies over all of Hebrew midwifery, if that's a word. Their names mean splendid one and beautiful one. Names are often significant in Scripture, and we'll come back to these names in a bit. But here are these two women, and they get called into Pharaoh's office. And they're told that the new plan is to take baby boys, newly born, and kill them. Shiphrah and Puah leave the palace, and undoubtedly they are thinking about their new job assignment. I don't know how long they deliberated. I mean, did they need to sleep on it? Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I don't know. Maybe they walked out of that palace already chuckling at Pharaoh's request, saying, yeah, right. We're not sure. But the bottom line is this. They defied him. They defied Pharaoh. They did not obey his command. They willingly place themselves at great personal risk of punishment or death by not following through with Pharaoh's murderous scheme. Now, what's happening here does not perfectly translate into our modern day understanding of defying a ruler. Let me just tell you what I mean. Today, you can go make a piñata of your leaders and bash them open and post it on YouTube for the world to see, run back to the safety of your parents' basement bedroom to wage war with your words on Facebook, and never lose a wink of sleep over any of it. Probably not the case in 1400s BC Egypt. Punishment from the king of Egypt is scary. This man has already proven his character in these short verses, and it's not good character. He most likely thinks, literally, he most likely thinks he is a god. He is power hungry. He is paranoid about a theoretical uprising that's not even happening. He is cruel. He does not value human life or the image of God. He is willing to enslave a whole nation and kill their children to keep his position secure. This is a bad man. Punishment from him is a very real likelihood, and it's very scary. If he won't hesitate to sentence countless babies to their death, he certainly won't hesitate to kill a couple of midwives. They knew that. They knew he could end their lives in a moment. Punishment from the king of Egypt is scary, but there was something in the hearts and in the minds of these two women that was a fate worse than death at Pharaoh's hand. There was something they dreaded more than defying the God King Pharaoh. Shiphrah and Puah would not consider obeying Pharaoh as an option because they feared God. They feared God, and that changed everything. I want us to think about this. These women genuinely, in their hearts, feared God. Fear in this biblical sense is not the boogeyman fear. It is a deep reverence. It is a correct understanding of roles. God is God, and I am not. This wasn't superstition, like carrying an idol on a chain for your safety. It wasn't simply inherited. You know, my grandmother believed in this stuff, so I guess I need to also. No, no. You don't put your life on the line for your grandma's religion. You don't defy Pharaoh for the sake of an expendable tradition. These women feared God. That means they had some knowledge about God, and they believed it. There was no Bible yet, so there was no sister's class. There was no Bible yet, but the Hebrew women, and I'm sorry, but the Hebrew people have been keen on oral tradition since their inception as a people. So these women grew up for sure hearing from the mouths of their fathers, mothers, grandparents, the stories of God and their people. They knew about creation. They knew about the fall of man, the flood of the earth, and they knew about their ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Importantly, they knew the promise that God would place his hand and favor upon this nation and rescue them and deliver them into a good place. And so they feared God. They didn't fear an abstract concept. They didn't fear knocking the universe out of alignment. They didn't fear a philosophy. They feared God. Sure, but didn't they fear Pharaoh too? Well, maybe they did. But not as much as they feared God. One outweighed the other. And that makes all the difference in this story. Rulers and kings have their place in the world. They are sovereignly appointed by God, it's true. But their rightful place is always distantly, I might even say infinitely, behind God Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. In the face of God's enemy, they feared God. And Pharaoh was indeed God's enemy. I don't want us to think that he was just a misunderstood man in the wrong place in the wrong time in history who got in the way. Oops. No, I would contend that Satan was very much at work behind Pharaoh. Now, how can I say that? Because, for one, nothing in this universe has ever occurred that has been neutral. Think about that. Nothing in this universe has ever happened that has been neutral in relation to God. Since the beginning, God has desired that humans worship him and represent him and fill the earth. And Satan has always tried, also since the beginning, to deceive and to destroy God's plans and to destroy God's people. That's been his plan since day one. The Bible creates no middle ground. So here we have a human king saying, "I am Lord over these people. I will rule them as I see fit. I will use them for my purposes. They will do my bidding, and my fame will spread." You see, Pharaoh would seek to take God's position. That is satanic. And we'll see this more as the story develops. So how involved directly was Satan in all of this? I don't know, but he couldn't have been far off. Pharaoh was carrying out Satan's mission to destroy God's plans and God's people. He is not a neutral character then. He's very much an enemy of God. An enemy that these two women opposed because of their correct understanding of who the Lord was. Now, you and I both know that it is one thing to give lip service to fearing God. I can say I fear God. Is that what these women did? You know, we fear God, but we have to follow orders. God hates what we're going to do, but we're stuck. We have to obey Pharaoh. No. What we see here is not only that Shipra and Puah confessed to fear God. No, they followed through with their actions. They followed through with their actions because they feared God. They did not kill the baby boys. Because they feared God, they did not kill the baby boys. They let the children live. Their actions supported and proved their confession. This reminds me somewhat, and only somewhat, of a story from back in 2015 that you might remember. I don't know if you follow the news, but the woman Kimberly Davis, she was the county clerk in Rowan County, Kentucky. Her name became well known because, as a Christian, she refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples in Rowan County, Kentucky. She's a Christian. She knows who God is and what His intentions are for marriage, and she would not participate in violating God's character. Even after she was jailed and released, she still would not participate in making a mockery of God's marriage institution, because when asked why, her reason was simply this: because of God's authority. That was her answer, and it was the right one. She saw the authority of God as higher than the authority of courts that opposed Him. Might we act based upon our fear of God? Maybe that sounds like a simple question, but it's one we should be asking ourselves daily. Might we act based upon our fear of God? While this story is in relation to subjects and a king over them, the principle carries over into every area of our lives. Now, most of us will never be in a position like Kimberly Davis was, probably. Most of us will not face gunpoint persecution and be told, denounce your faith or die. Probably, but we don't know. None of us, I can pretty confidently say this, none of us will be commanded by Pharaoh to kill Hebrew children. I don't think. But this truth is not just reserved for a few big ticket items. It is applicable in all the details of our lives as God's people. The role of God in our lives should be the foremost factor in all decision making, in the details of normal days as well as during the crisis. Our words with our spouse and our kids, how we interact with our coworkers, being informed by our healthy fear of God. How we use our resources reflects what we fear or esteem. Do we react in patience or anger? Do we stand for what we know to be true in conversations, or do we keep quiet because we don't want to disturb the peaceful waters? So we can learn from Shifra and Puah without having to face Pharaoh. Am I living in a way where my life matches my confession, like they did? These women were, and their actions, like their names, were both splendid and beautiful because they feared God. But friends, let me point out the obvious real quick before we do the second point. If you want to live in the fear of God, you have to know God. If you want to live in the fear of God, you have to know God. This isn't a free-for-all. God is real, and He has really revealed Himself to us through His Holy Bible. This book He has. We meet Him here. We know Him here. And we can't live in a manner that represents Him unless we know Him. I would say there's a direct correlation between your time with God in this book and in prayer and how your life mirrors the fear of God. You have to know Him if you want to represent Him. The God-fearing life is not simply a mental exercise. Like Shifra and Puah, the God-fearing life is observable through our decisions. So let the story call you to this. Let the story refresh in you the need to filter your day-to-day decisions and interactions through the fear of God. And meet Him in His Word and through prayer so that you might represent Him well. That should be our prayer for ourselves individually, as family units and corporately. These women feared God. They feared God more than they feared Pharaoh. And that is the hinge of this whole story. Think about that. That is the glimmer of hope. Without that detail, this would just be a very sad story. But we see this glimmer of hope for the children of Israel first manifest in the midwives. Things are bad. They're all slaves. Oh man, now they want to kill us off. But the fear of God is here. And God has promised to act. And that's my second point. Fear God as He works. Fear God as He works. Verses 17 and 18 read like this. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them. But they let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this? And let the male children live." Busted. The jig is up. They've been found out. Pharaoh has noticed, apparently, on his morning walk, that there were a bunch of crying baby boys filling the streets or something. He notices, and so he calls these two women to himself, and he wants to know, what is the deal? Why have you done this and let the male children live? Now, this part of the story is a little bit of a mystery to me. And it should cause us to pause. Because not only is their answer not that believable, but it is actually insulting to the women of Egypt. It would have been enough to say, the babies are all born before we get there. Let's look at what they actually say, though. The midwife said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." It would have been enough to say the babies are all born before we get there, but they add this comparison to the Egyptian women. The Hebrew women, they're saying, the Hebrew women know it's time to give birth and they get it done. They're like Sammy. No problem. They aren't like the Egyptian women who, by implication, are not hearty. They are not strong. They kind of need help. They are weaker. They take longer. You see what they're saying? What possessed these women to take this route of reason in the presence of Pharaoh? I don't know. But God smiled on their obedience, and God preserved them. They suffered no punishment that we ever read about. In fact, we see just the opposite of punishment. These women, Shiphrah and Puah, they were taken care of. It went well with them, the text says. Look at verse 21. Or verse 20, rather. God dealt well with the midwives, down in 21. Because the midwives feared God, He gave them families. So, He gave them families. Now, pause for a minute. See this. We have to see this. Pharaoh is seeking to decrease the people of God. He wants them to shrink. He wants them to diminish. As we read back in verses 11 and 12, he oppressed them more. How did that work out? Well, they kept multiplying and they spread abroad, Exodus says. I know, Pharaoh thinks, I'll take out the next generation by eliminating the males. And what happens? Well, the midwives fear God. And the result? The nation keeps increasing because the babies live. God then increases the nation again by blessing the midwives with their own families. And then, to top it off, in verse 20 we read, the people multiplied and grew very strong. Are you picking up on this? Pharaoh, the enemy of God, can do nothing to stop God's plans. Nothing works. It's hilarious. God has promised to build a nation, and He is building a nation. Right under Pharaoh's nose. Maybe that's why it fell off the Sphinx. The slavery didn't stop God. The slavery didn't stop Him. The setting in a foreign land didn't stop God. The mandate to kill these boys didn't stop God. What can stop God's plans? Look, I know the Exodus story starts on a low note. The people of God are in captivity. They are worked to the bone. Their ruler is against them and against their God. At this point, there's no deliverer coming to get them that they know of. And despite all of this, what rings loud and clear as a bell is that God in heaven has no rival, and that His plans will march forward. He will succeed in every endeavor. And we fear Him as He does it. We fear God because God makes promises and He keeps promises. Shifra and Puah knew that. So they feared God in the face of His enemies and as He worked. They knew it and we know it. Friends, today, let the Word of God push you into a greater fear of God. Let this story show you that our God cannot be stopped, and may God bring you and me to a place of greater trust in Him as He continues to follow through on His plans and His promises. You could say, well, God didn't make the promises to me that He had made to Abraham and the children of Israel. I mean, these ladies had a real, tangible promise to cling to. They knew their people would become a great nation, and we don't have that promise. You're right. We don't have that promise. We have a better one. We have a better set of promises, really. Let me remind you of a few of them for just a moment. Romans 8 says, "Those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, in order that He might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom He predestined, He also called. And those whom He called, He also justified. And those whom He justified, He also glorified." That's a promise from God. Romans 10 says, "There is no distinction between Jew and Greek, for the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing His riches on all who call on Him." Here's a promise: "For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved." Ephesians 2 says, "Remember that you were at that time separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For He Himself is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down in His flesh the dividing wall of hostility by abolishing the law of commandments expressed in ordinances, that He might create in Himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby killing the hostility." That's a good promise. Matthew 16 says, "I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." What a great promise. "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Psalm 82 verse 8 says, "Arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all the nations." What a good promise. Revelation 21 says, "And He who was seated on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.' Also He said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.' And He said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of water of life without payment.' The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son." How's that for a set of promises? And that's just a sampling. The child of God stands upon many, many promises. Promises of assurance. Promises of deliverance. Promises of victory. Promises of recreation and the making new of all things. Promises of the defeat of God's enemies and the ultimate gathering of all His people in victory over the bonds of sin and death in a new heavens and a new earth. You can find all of those promises here. All these are promised and made sure by the sacrifice of Jesus in the place of sinners. There is no greater foundation for a promise. We even know from reading Galatians and other passages that Jesus Himself is the greatest fulfillment of these promises to Abraham, that through Jesus all families of the earth would be blessed. Brothers and sisters, we have the full picture that Shipra and Puah did not have. God promised deliverance to them. They believed God and they acted accordingly in their lives. We have been delivered from being slaves to our own wills and are being delivered into glory. And so we must live accordingly. Live like the promises are true. Now, here I am saying that Christians ought to fear God and act accordingly as He carries out His plans. Now, I know it's easy to become convicted over an issue like this one, like fearing God. It's easy to become convicted over this, sit back and say, man, if only other Christians would do this. If only other Christians would get their act together on this level. If only other Christians would act this way, if they would only see things this way, oh, things would be better for the kingdom. Maybe you've heard a wide spectrum of this. If only Christians would get unified over this one issue. If only all Christians would just vote this way. If only Christians would get over their petty denominational differences. Man, we could finally have a global church and oh boy, then we could really get some stuff done. Unity is a good thing. Don't hear what I'm not saying. Unity is a good thing. Wanting to see other Christians do well is a good thing. But run this thought experiment with me. What if, instead of lamenting what the rest of Christendom is doing wrong, what if we, as individual Christians and as a local body, what if we focused on what was doing right with what lay directly in front of us? What if we looked at our lives and responsibilities and asked, what is the best way to carry on with my duties and responsibilities in a way that fears God? A friend and mentor to me, who many of you know, Greg Dernberger, gave me this simple and good wisdom last year. I've been saying it to myself daily. He said, the Christian life is a life of constantly asking yourself, what is the next right thing to do? Let me urge you, friends, to think locally in this sense. Is God moving globally? Well, yes, He is. Is He doing things all over the world for His kingdom? Yes, He is. But what has He charged you to do? He's charged you to be responsible with what He has placed before you. Your words, your choices, your resources. Shipra and Puah, they walked out of Pharaoh's presence and they made a decision to do the next right thing that would show the fear of God. The godly thing concerning the issue that lay right before them. Pharaoh wants us to kill children. We're not going to do it. Now, I share all that to hopefully be helpful with the application of this text, because this isn't a call for us to take a larger stage on social media and call people who we've never met to greater fear of God and greater obedience. That's not what it is. No, it is a call for us to a greater fear of God and a greater obedience here and now in our lives. Even and especially when no one is watching in the day-to-day details of life. These women didn't make this choice to get a few minutes of fame. Think about that. They didn't make this choice because they wanted their names written down in the Bible. They didn't know God was in the process of writing the Christian Bible and that they would be memorialized in this book and be the subject of this sermon thousands of years later. They feared God and they did the next right thing. By the power of His Spirit and according to His Word, may we do the same for the fear of God and for the fame of Jesus. And if you're wondering, what's the point? What difference can we really make in the details of our life? Things are hopeless. You don't know my situation. Maybe I don't. But there will always be a glimmer of hope as long as God is always working. And He is always working. Would you please pray with me?